This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. If you're a dedicated browser of secondhand bookstores, you've probably come across the volumes of the Everyman's Library. Small, beautifully bound hardcovers that each feature this statement on the title page: "Every man, I will go with thee and be thy guide in thy most need to go by thy side." The library is a literary treasure that includes more than 1,000 titles, from Austen to Dickens to Marcus Aurelius. In 1906, the Everyman Library was practically a philanthropic mission. Its founder, Joseph Mallaby Dent, called it a democratic library at the democratic price of 1 shilling. 100 years later, the publishing house of Alfred A. Knopf relaunched the library, though it set prices a bit higher than 1 shilling. Along the way, though, Knopf acquired the question inherent to the library: what belongs in a modern Everyman edition? What constitutes a classic? This hour, we'll talk with the publisher and head of Knopf about those questions. We'll also talk with authors Joan Didion and Z.Z. Packers about what they think makes a classic. Later on in the program, we'll talk with the authors of the book Impounded, which, if you'd like to take a look at some of the previously unreleased photos of World War II American internment camps, you can go to our webpage at npr.org. But first, what is a classic and what isn't? How do you tell a literary lion from a mere cub? And what books get overlooked? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. Joining us now from the BBC studios in New York is the chairman and publisher of Knopf, Sonny Mehta. Nice to have you on the program today.
It's nice to be here.
The original Everyman Library was a rather remarkable achievement that began 100 years ago. Tell us a little bit about its original mission.
Well, it was started in February 1906 by Joseph Dent, who was a kind of a master London bookbinder turned publisher and was a classic Victorian autodidact. He was the 10th child of a house painter in Darlington, who left school at the age of 13 and arrived in London and decided that he wanted to have a library that basically of beautiful books that encompassed all that was lasting in literature. And his ambition was that for a few shillings, the reader may have a whole bookshelf of the immortals. Hmm. For £5, he will procure him 100 volumes, and that a man may be intellectually rich for life.
And as he went about this, now he's not an academic. He's not somebody familiar with even the book publishing business. How did he decide what was a classic and what wasn't?
Well, I think he and his son, and they had an extremely gifted editor who was instrumental, I think, in helping the books be chosen, a man called Ernest Rees, who essentially edited the complete library until his death. They made some choices that might be considered sort of eccentric now, but I think the first British author to have a complete works included in the Everyman Library was Jane Austen.
And not Shakespeare.
It was Jane Austen, I believe, to have the complete works.
Yes.
Shakespeare was probably was there very early on, but the complete Jane Austen, I think, was the first complete set published. He was followed by Dickens with an introduction by C.K. Chesterton. Then came the great sort of Europeans, Dostoevsky, Rabelais, Rousseau, Flaubert, Stendhal. And then the near contemporaries, Robert Louis Stevenson, Henry James, Conrad, D.H. Lawrence, W. Somerset Maugham, Virginia Woolf, and a host of people in between who really aren't read as frequently as the authors I've just mentioned.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you took over this this imprint, you had some decisions to make yourself. Now, I assume some of these relate to questions like, what can I get the rights to? But other than that, if it was an open intellectual question, how do you define a classic?
Well, there are probably as many definitions about what makes a classic, I think, as classics, actually. I think it was... I think it was Mark Twain who described it as a book which people praise and don't read. The one I feel closest to is Clifton Fadiman's, and he said, when you read a classic, you do not see more in the book than you did before. You see more in you than there was before.
I guess by Twain's definition, it would be a Brief History of Time would be qualified as a classic.
Well, yes, I can think of some others, too, as a matter of fact.
Are there any that you've looked at and said, you know, maybe later, but not right now?
Yes, I mean, we're considering books all the time. We have we have a website that we encourage people to send in their suggestions, and we've had some very interesting suggestions, some of which actually have had pertain to books that we actually had in the pipeline, like say Paul Scott's The Raj Quartet.
Mm.
But there have been some others that we haven't acted on. Like, for instance, there was a suggestion quite recently that we consider Jeffrey Fison's 1950 bestseller, Hot Rod. I don't know whether you've come across that.
I seem to have missed it in my education, yes.
It's a huge bestseller through the 50s, and we don't think we're quite ready for that yet.
We're going to want your suggestions on both classics that might be considered and on the question, what constitutes a classic, if you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. But first, let's welcome Joan Didion to the conversation. Her new collected book of nonfiction has been released as part of the Knopf Everyman series. It's called We Tell Ourselves Stories in Order to Live, and she joins us from her home in New York, and it's nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today.
It's nice to be here.
Now you've been included in the pantheon of nonfiction in the Everyman Library. It's I guess you can go to bed happy.
Well, it's a little daunting, I have to say. It was an exciting thing.
How do you think the decisions ought to be made? I don't know
I don't even know what a classic is. It seems to me that basically what you're talking about at any given time, you're always going to end up with things that are going to seem eccentric to later generations.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a certain body of knowledge at any given time, certain shared narratives and shared information, that if you had a collection of books, you would, and everybody read all those, we would all share some knowledge,
mm-hmm.
and we would share some values maybe. But it's kind of something you feel as you go along.
Now, you know Sonny Maida, and I wonder, do you call him up every once in a while after you see a new edition in a bookstore and said, you've got to be kidding?
No, I've never done that. No, I feel generally it seems to me the choices have been quite good.
Hmm. And as you say, it must be daunting to have your own work included in such a list.
Well, yes, it is. The other thing about Everyman's Library is basically it seems to me that most of the books in it have crossed two generations, which I hesitate to say is now true of my early work.
Mm-hmm.
It has now been read by two generations, and that's basically all we're talking about, I think.
And Sonny Maida, all of the stuff that we were talking about initially was fiction. Obviously, Joan Didion's nonfiction work is what you've included here.
In this particular volume, yes, this is just nonfiction. But I think Dent set out not just to publish fiction. He did publish nonfiction, too. I'm thinking about Lord Chesterfield's letters to his grandson, for mm-hmm. instance. There was a great deal of nonfiction because, there will be more in the Everyman that we are currently working on.
Hmm. Let's see if we can get a listener on the line. And this is Brooke. Brooke joins us from Oklahoma City.
Hello, how are you guys today?
Okay.
Great. I'm an English teacher, and oftentimes I'm dialoguing with folks on the Advanced Placement website. And we often have the conversation about a book's literary merit. And I was wondering if our guests saw that literary merit and classic as interchangeable terms or if they're different terms.
What do you think, Joan Didion?
Well, as I say, I have trouble defining classic. so I don't know. I mean,
in great fights about what literary merit is. So
something. I mean, we do want literary merit. I think all of us. There was a book that was in the sort of in the it was high school reading at the time I was in high school, and at the time it was nationwide. It was a book that it was Giants in the Earth. It was called. It was by a Norwegian named Rolvag.
Sure.
It was about American immigration, but it all took place in the Midwest. It was equally mystifying to me in Sacramento and to my husband, who was also assigned it in West Hartford, Connecticut. I mean, certain books are assigned because they reflect a societal value.
Yes.
So no threat to Sonny Mehta that Giants in the Earth is going to be the next edition in the Everyman's Library.
Well, I did, in fact, buy it about 8 months after I came to work in America, which was about 18 years ago. I was traveling, and someone had taken me, I think, to either, I think it was Seattle, and we were making a progress across that sector, sort of visiting bookstores, and I bought a copy of that because everyone told me it was a classic. I'm still reading it.
Savoring every word, I take it.
Absolutely.
Yes. Brooke, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you all. Great.
Bye, and good luck with your class.
Thank you.
And Joan Didion, we wanted to thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, thank you.
Joan Didion, her collected nonfiction, We Tell Ourselves Stories in Order to Live, is one of six new releases in Knopf's Everyman's Library. And we'll be back with Sonny Mehta and more of your calls after a short break. If you'd like to join us, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. This is the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today about what makes a classic with somebody who should know, Sonny Mehta, the publisher and editor-in-chief of Alfred A. Knopf, the publishing company, which puts out now the Everyman's Library series. The introductions to all the books in the Everyman series are commissioned especially for those editions. To read A.S. Byatt's introduction to Toni Morrison's Beloved, you can go to our website at npr.org/talk. And, of course, we want your ideas on what makes a classic and what doesn't. Give us a call, 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK. Email us, talk@npr.org. And let's turn to Mark. Mark's with us from Paddle Creek or Battle Creek, Michigan, is that it?
Battle Creek, sir.
Battle Creek, home of Kellogg's. Go ahead.
That's right. Well, to me, a classic is a book that deals with a classic meta theme very well. And I think of James Agee's A Death in the Family. You know, to me, that was a quintessential story about a young man who, you know, had a emerging relationship with his father and how it was cut short and, you know, the tragedy about that, only to be mirrored in real life by James Agee's own tragedy as he died before the book was finished. So I wonder how you feel about that, the idea of a classic being defined by how it treats a classic theme.
Well, it is an absolutely wonderful book. I still remember it from when I read it as a much younger person. I think a classic always has is built around scenes that remain sort of quintessentially sort of memorable and frequently more than one scene. That was a remarkable book, and it is built around one quintessential scene. That is absolutely right.
Hmm. Well, maybe you've given James
and actually, you know, I think James Agee probably does deserve a place in any classic collection.
Mark, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Let's go to this will be David. David with us from St. Joseph, Missouri.
Yes, I had a question regarding science fiction. Is there any science fiction novels that are part of the classic collection that we speak of, or Is it vacant of those?
Not yet, but I can think of some science fiction writers who definitely should be inside there. Philip K. Dick, sort of principally.
That was kind of my comment, was that it seems oftentimes science fiction is snubbed when it comes to regarding as a classic. But I think that Frank Herbert's Dune and obviously Asimov's Foundation, there are probably a few.
Some of those are still in print. It might be pricey.
I agree with you absolutely. And then, of course, they have been classics of futuristic writing from the past that are very much part of any sort of ongoing classics collection. I'm thinking about H.G. Wells. I'm thinking about Jules Verne.
Who may not have been great writers themselves, though pretty good and sold a lot of books, nevertheless, important creativity. Well, but there are other genres, not just science fiction. I mean, would Dashiell Hammett be part of the Everyman series?
Actually, yes, Dashiell Hammett is, and we're issuing a second volume. We have one volume in print. We're issuing a second volume, which is being introduced by James Ellroy. And we already have Raymond Chandler and James M. Cain.
The three biggies of the hard-boiled school.
Some of the best science fiction, while perhaps not as literary, the themes and the stories behind them, they involve a great deal of, you know, social awareness and a good understanding of the way a culture functions and operates and those sorts of things. And again, I think of Frank Herbert and Dune and Asimov and his Foundation series. They span
I think you're absolutely right.
Absolutely. Wonderful.
And if you have any ideas, please send them in. We can use all the help we can get.
Oh, very good. Thank you all very much. Take care.
David, thanks very much. And if listeners like David wanted to send their ideas directly to you, how would they do that?
Email is probably the best way of getting hold of me. It's smetha@randomhouse.com.
And that's M-E-H-T-A?
That's right.
Okay. And all right, let's see if we can get another caller on the line. And this is, if I find the right button, Robert. Robert with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi, thanks for my call.
Sure.
Suggested book be To Kill a Mockingbird. And I know that it's, after having won a Nobel, many may consider it that it's already a classic, but I fear that future generations may no longer consider it a classic or essential reading as social attitudes change, or at least people's perceptions of common social attitudes would change. I think that a book like To Kill a Mockingbird is essential reading because it reminds us of some of the injustices that can be taken against the disenfranchised.
I agree with you. If we could get hold of the rights, I assure you we'd have it in the Everyman's Library. But the book has been continuously in print. It's read all over the world. It's read in India, where I come from. It's read in England, where I worked, and it's read in Australia. It's read where anyone reads the English language.
Robert, thanks very much.
Welcome.
ZZ Packer is a writer and author of the short story collection Drinking Coffee Elsewhere. She's working on a forthcoming novel about Buffalo soldiers, and she joins us now from the studios of our member station in San Francisco, KQED. Nice to have you on the program today.
Nice to be here. Hi, Neil.
Hi.
Mr. Beta.
Hi.
What do you think makes a classic, ZZ Packer?
I think that there's a reason why writers kind of shy away from the question, because we kind of feel as though we're always constantly, you know, trying to maybe write a classic, but of course we don't want to admit to having the ego of saying that we actually do. It's very difficult. I think that the terminology has changed just over the centuries. I mean, it used to be that in the university, that literature itself, just as a, you know, realm of study, was considered kind of a bastard sort of stepchild to the actual classics, meaning like the Greeks and the Latins,
right, yeah,
and that kind of thing. And now the very things that would have been considered just mere titillating sort of entertainments back then, like, you know, the things I had to read that I fell asleep reading, like Clarissa and Shyamala and Pamela and all of those things, are, I guess, by some people still considered classics. But the way I usually think of it is, you know, just something that's a piece of literature that speaks across generations and oftentimes deals with truths in ways that are sometimes hard or difficult to deal with or wrestle with. So the one caller talked about, you know, a classic meta theme, and I would almost sort of shy away from that because that sort of tends to suggest that it's merely theme or merely if you come up with a certain subject matter, then that's, you know, that's grounds for declaring something a classic. And I think it's much more about the style and the substance than just theme.
Yeah, otherwise it'd be a template and we'd all know what a classic was.
Exactly.
Yeah. Is there anything in the canon that, I don't know if you're looking at the actual list of every man's library, but...
I'm not.
You know, everything in the canon that you think, you know, it's easy, in fact, to add stuff. You know, oh, gee willikers, how could they possibly skip this? A little harder to take some stuff off sometimes.
Yeah, but then the generations to come, the younger generations are always sort of loath to say, well, I'm going to take away something like, you know, the Heart of Midlothian or something,
right,
you know, something like that, because, you know, who are you to judge? That's sort of the feeling. But I do think that, you know, there has been a stronger push for people to want to include those books that always seem to be breaking new ground. So, and many classics, I mean, start off being somewhat unpopular in their day, and then later their importance becomes known. And I think, but I think that the sort of time span in which that occurs has been narrowing over the years, to the point that it almost seems like it takes, you know, a little less than 10 years, whereas maybe before it would almost take, you know, almost a century or something.
Let's see if we get another caller on the line. This is Holly. Holly's with us from Fenora in California.
Yes, hi.
Hi.
We use a classical approach in my schooling. I homeschool my kids, and we use a classical education approach, whatever that means. So we've had this discussion often about what constitutes a classic. And I would have to say that my feelings of what it is has somewhat evolved, and I love what your new guest is saying. A lot of what I've thought of a classic has come to be what your guest has been saying just now. And that is that classics seem to be those, to me, that over the years appealed to the masses, that maybe were popular when they first came out, and maybe not, maybe more controversial. But that there's an appeal to the masses, and tackles themes that may be uncomfortable, maybe challenges society, challenges political views or religious beliefs. So some of my thoughts are there, and one reason that my thoughts have come this way is I recently attended a lecture series, and included on the reading list of classics that we were to have read was a Louis L'Amour book, and I really struggled with calling that a classic and why it would be included on that list.
Well, let me ask Sunny Maida, first of all. Would you think of Louis L'Amour, the great Western writer, as eligible for Everyman's?
Well, he wrote an awful lot of books, and there were sequences of novels that, if I remember them rightly from my teenage years, that followed whole sections of families over a period of time. The Sacketts, I think, was one of them. I'm not sure that I would, but on the other hand, Owen Wister's The Virginian. I don't know whether you've ever come across that.
No.
That I think probably might qualify, but there are other great novels about the West.
Some of Cooper's stuff, Fenimore Cooper's stuff would
Fenimore
qualify.
Cooper, yeah, yes.
As if you think of the Catskills as the West, it was at one time.
And, you know, basically in their time, these were writers as popular in a mass sense as Louis L'Amour became later on.
I wonder. Did you go through the list at one point and say, you know, there's some. Well, this would be my characterization and not yours. But there's some real Castor Royal books here that we might want to think about skipping over this time around. I mean, does anybody read Pilgrim's Progress anymore?
Our family does.
Your family does. All right. I'm shot down by Holly there in Fenora, California.
She brought up an interesting point about Louis L'Amour just being genre fiction. I mean, typically, and the other caller talked about science fiction and, what was its place. And I think typically genre fiction doesn't, or a genre writer doesn't sort of get ranked as being, one of the classics until they sort of break out of that particular genre in some way.
You mean transcended in some way.
Exactly, yes. Because it seems as though if you're writing in a genre to begin with, you're automatically agreeing to a set of conventions that generally affirms a particular societal position. So for Westerns, generally, there's the idea that there's a promotion of, this idea of manifest destiny and that the settlers on some level were right. And, with science fiction, there is always the ambiguity with the way the world works, but you have your machines and this and that, and only when you begin to break out and sort of go towards the idea of there being a central human condition that we're wrestling with do the sort of genre writers like Owen Wister and some of the other science fiction writers do they manage to usually just be considered a classic.
Holly, thanks very much for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And have a good time with John Bunyan.
Thank you. We will.
Bye-bye. We're talking about what constitutes a classic. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get Joe on the line. Joe's calling us from LaCroix in Wisconsin.
I am, and thank you so much for taking my call, because
sure.
I get to talk to people about books, which I don't frequently get to do. So first, a couple comments. One is, as far as science fiction goes, I think if you start to look at an author like Robert Heinlein, who wrote Stranger in a Strange Land, which is probably the... If you look at a book that you could base the free love generation on from the 60s, you'd probably have to go with that as much as anything else. And the other thing is the Louis L'Amour book that I suspect they were talking about is a book called The Walking Drum, which in the introduction to it, L'Amour said is the only book he wrote for him, and so, of course, he made no money on it. And it's the story of a 13th century young man named Kerr Bouchard and his adventure to find himself. And one of your guests mentioned, a meta theme that overarches that she was opposed to. But I think if you look at it not as an encompassing theme, but as an opening theme, space not as something that holds spaces as merely a container, then you can say that the overarching theme must be like all be said of theater, it must change you.
Z.Z. Packer was objecting to that as the sole definition and not merely to that as an idea, but she can defend herself. But go ahead anyway. I'm sorry, Joe.
and because I think that's it. It doesn't matter whether it's a personal narrative that changes you. I mean, my connection to Everyman, which is like many years ago, I first read Emerson and Thomas Carlyle, Heroes, Hero Worship, and the Heroic in History, and Everyman editions that a very wonderful friend of mine loaned to me one day. And so, but it must change you, because that's what great literature does. That's what great art does. That's what great anything does, ultimately, when you get right down to it. So it's wonderful to see this discussion today. And it really is, I don't think it's a bad thing to consider Louis L'Amour, who wrote many popular books about the West, but it was his one book about the West that I suspect they wanted to include on there. Mm-hmm. And science fiction, somebody like Orson Scott Card or Robert Heinlein.
Oh, let me throw in Alfred Bester. So go ahead, anyway.
Oh, Bester, Stars My Destination, maybe the greatest sociological observation in what would be termed a science fiction book ever written. Man is a social animal first and a member and an individual second. That stuff's great, but that's what changes people. That's what makes you aware. And it's that change in your awareness that I think is what qualifies for anything to be termed great. And that's why we can't decide what that is. But we can certainly come up with some things that affect a lot of people in a lot of ways and say, hey, here's the canon. Here's what we found is effective in being effective. And I think that's a great start. And I think the Everyman Library deserves accolades over and over again for being part of that. And keep Pilgrim's Progress and keep Mephistopheles and keep everything else. Because, someday somebody will pick up a copy in an attic and read it, and that will be the beginning of their life.
Joe, thanks very much for the call. That's a great call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And Sunny Maida, just a few seconds before we let you go, but when you make decisions about what's in the Everyman's Library series, do you sit at a big meeting? Are there a lot of important people there? You sit in your office by yourself and just thumb through the book?
No, well, there's a group of us who are who work on this, chiefly Luann Walton. She's got a group of people. We meet periodically. We send emails to each other. We say, what about this? What about that? We have an advisory board that we run ideas by, and they sometimes make recommendations to us.
you know, we argue.
That sounds like as good a basis for a series of books as any. Sunny Mehta, thank you very much for being with us today. We appreciate
your
time.
Thank you so much.
Sunny Mehta is publisher and editor-in-chief of Alfred A. Knopf, and he joined us from the BBC studios in New York. ZZ Packer, thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
ZZ Packer is author of Drinking Coffee Elsewhere and a forthcoming novel about Buffalo Soldiers. With us today from the studios of our member station in San Francisco, KQED. When we come back from a short break, a book of newly released photographs that document the internment of Japanese Americans. The editors of Impounded join us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.